Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. The job at hand is coming to terms with American reality. 400 years of history and day-to-day evidence in work and wealth gaps, in health and hierarchy, in criminal injustice and scandalous policing. The charge is racism. And in a national roar of response to the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the leading prescription seems to be anti-racism. That includes both quiet introspection and very public reordering of public safety enforcement. For starters, change is coming, and in a few instances like the one we're dwelling on this hour, change has already come. Rachel Rollins got elected district attorney 2 years ago for Boston and the adjoining cities of Chelsea, Winthrop, and Revere. Her campaign promise was to change the system, to decarcerate criminal justice, to decriminalize poverty, drug disorders, and mental illness, to drop prosecutions of a dozen or more petty crimes like shoplifting and carrying drug paraphernalia. Rachel Rollins' project, she's affirming in our conversation, is to undo a generation of mass incarceration.
My goal is to have a more equitable and just criminal legal system. My goal is to have a criminal legal system where no matter your zip code, get the same outcome. Right now, we have a system where you are better off being rich and guilty than poor and innocent, to quote the fabulous Bryan Stevenson. Oh. I envision a world where we are not the catch basin at the end of many, many systemic failures, which we currently are. And the police and members of law enforcement are being asked to do far too much because other systems have failed.
Rachel, you wrote a very personal letter to your staff and your community that the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis 2 weeks ago just knocked you for a loop. Take us into that turmoil in your own head.
Chris, seeing that video coupled with watching the video of Ahmaud Arbery be murdered, and I would argue Ahmaud Arbery is also a police murder because the father of Travis McMichael was a former Glenn County police officer, had worked for decades in the DA's office, and there are text messages from the police telling the landowner of the property that was being built that Ahmaud was allegedly trespassing on, please call Mr. McMichael, he's former law enforcement, if you have any issues. Mm-hmm. That's essentially deputizing him. Looking at Ahmaud Arbery, looking at George Floyd, watching that execution by law enforcement or their proxy, coupled with Breonna Taylor, who with a no-knock warrant, looking for a man that had been arrested earlier that day, killed a Black EMS worker, woman, in her sleep in her home, and none of those officers has been arrested yet. With Omar Jimenez and Christian Cooper, all of those things happened within a short series of time together. And it was honestly just too much for many people. I hope anyone with a soul that watched those things was deeply impacted. But for Black people, of which I am, this is just an intergenerational trauma that we have experienced since we've even been born. So it was haunting to me. I was teetering between rage and just profound sorrow and exhaustion. But I felt compelled to speak that to my staff, to show them the importance of this role that I have been honored to serve in and elected to serve in, and the privilege we have of serving the people of Suffolk County in the DA's office.
Rachel Rollins, I mean, there's a bit of a war of words with you and the Boston police about comments you've made about the George Floyd murder. And we'll get into that, how serious or not serious is that spat. But I want to hear you talk about how you got where you are. I got to say, in my lifetime, the Boston DA's office ran a strong office with a distinctly Boston, Irish, and political flavor, sort of boot camp for generations of Boston lawyers, Ted Kennedy among them, Kevin White, who became a four-term mayor of Boston. It was a badge of honor to have done time as an assistant prosecutor with Garrett Byrne or Newman Flanagan. And along comes Rachel Rollins 2 years ago to beat the old Irish machine, not so unlike AOC getting elected to Congress and Ayanna Pressley to Tip O'Neill's old seat. And now I hear the wise guy saying Rachel Rollins plays speed chess with the Irish boys and more than holds her own. I've heard you quoted saying, "I'm fluent in white Irish male." Talk about the politics of getting where you got.
Yeah, so two things. It is still an honor to work in this office, and I inherited a fantastic office of exceptional staff from Dan Conley, Ralph Martin, even John Pappas, who was appointed by the governor for a few months prior to me taking office. And you talk about the old Irish guard. I'm the new Irish, right?
So well, your dad was Irish,
right? My father
right?
still is, not was, still is, actively Irish. So I can tell you, really, I feel the most qualifying background point about me is I'm biracial and I am multicultural just from the moment I was conceived, right? So I have a second generation Mayo, Ireland father, working class, poor, grew up in all areas of South Boston and Roslindale, still have family in West Roxbury and elsewhere, veteran, enlisted in the Navy, was a Navy corpsman, didn't get drafted, walked up and himself volunteered to serve this country. We do not share many of the same politics, but I obviously am deeply in love and grateful for my father. And I recognize that but for his service, I would not be able to have the opinions I have. So I listen to everything he says, deep respect for law enforcement. All of my uncles and grandfathers and great grandfathers on my father's side have served in the military from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, et cetera. So I grew up in this world with Irish men and women, of course, but mostly men that were members of law enforcement. So I was raised with a deep respect for law enforcement. As I've said, my dad's a former corrections officer just for a few years before working in Boston Public Schools. But I will tell you, Chris, when my parents met in 1969, Boston was not, you know, as welcoming as it is considered to some right now. And that is simply a fact. That is not disparaging the wonderful city of Boston. We have evolved. We have still work to do. But my parents chose to raise a family on Harlem Street in Dorchester. But very shortly after being there, it was incredibly tense for them. And they chose to move ultimately to Cambridge and raise their family there, which was much more multicultural and welcoming at the time to a white man marrying a black woman.
Interesting.
Yeah, and my father's family, they disowned him when he married my mother, but came back like most families do and evolved and was able to adapt to a change. But Chris, change is hard. I've seen this my whole life. So I feel like I'm perfectly poised in this role to have some very uncomfortable conversations about race, which I think our country has failed at miserably, unlike Germany and South Africa and other places, which have really atoned and reckoned with their past and tried to move forward with an eye to the harm that they've done in the past.
You're a woman of the moment. I mean, it's fascinating. But come back to the very big promises you made, clear, explicit, in your campaign. You say you're going to deliver justice for everyone in the courtroom, including the defendants. Also, you want to draw law enforcement, it seems, back from management of mental illness and addiction, for example. Move resources away from the arrest and prosecution of low-level nonviolent crimes. Police, of course, got into that kind of social work because the welfare state was running out on the cities, running out on anti-poverty politics. Where are you driving it?
So, Chris, anyone who's actually ever practiced criminal law in a municipal or district court, anyone, whether they agree with my politics or not, ask them. They know that today's victim is potentially tomorrow's defendant and was yesterday's witness in a crime. So in my office, if we fail you in juvenile, if we don't get you the services and treatment you need or put you in contact with all of the social and community-based opportunities and services that are provided for individuals that come in contact with the criminal legal system. We see you again in narcotics or gang, potentially, if you've been failed, or you might just jump right over narcotics and gang, and we will see you in the homicide unit as a defendant or target, or as a victim, who has been either in major felonies or the gang unit, you know, shot and harmed or killed, unfortunately. So anyone who knows this knows that when I say we are the Commonwealth, which includes, of course, victims and witnesses and police and civilians and residents, irrespective of their immigration status, but it also includes defendants and their families because they are part of the Commonwealth. Of course, the defendants have their own counsel, you bet, and they have qualified, able counsel. The defendant includes the Commonwealth. And when I talk about the types of crimes that in the first instance, I don't want to prosecute, I'd rather get them treatment or services. Chris, if we look at what happened with George Floyd, he was murdered by Derek Chauvin over a counterfeit $20 bill. That is a misdemeanor. That is a low-level, nonviolent crime that police were called to interact with individuals. So what I can tell you is these type of low-level crimes are why I wanted less encounters with law enforcement. Every one of these encounters that are nonviolent, non-serious can escalate in a moment as they had with George Floyd. My list of 15 crimes that I was not going to prosecute in the first instance, why I am known nationally as one of the, I'm proud to say, most progressive DAs in the United States, is because of public defenders, because of people at CPCS who met with me in their homes, who broke bread with me and explained to me the failures of the system. And those individuals are exactly why I came up with that list of 15, as well as judges, members of law enforcement, and returning citizens. So I have a deep respect for people who are public defenders, but I hold us all to a high standard, including myself and my office.
Rachel Rollins is the Boston model of anti-racist law enforcement, and she's just warming up. Coming up, revising the standard alliance between the prosecutor's office and the police. This is Open Source. It's not just in Boston. There's a war of words out there, or the sounds of a marriage breaking up, policemen and their unions rebuking elected officials who used to be their best friends. The district attorney in Boston is not shy when she speaks to the cops and to us about the tension. Rachel Rollins, come back to your relations with the Boston police. On the general premise that the nature of the job is that DAs everywhere get wedded sooner or later to the police. They make your cases, traditionally get a lot of your witnesses and evidence, but you're at odds with them, especially since the George Floyd murder. What is serious there and what is not? How serious are the tensions between you and Boston cops, the unions too, as well as the management?
What I think people need to slow down and recognize is Commissioner Gross is appointed by the mayor and his management. He is the face of the police department. I have a profound respect for the commissioner. We sit on the NOBLE board together, National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Officers. We immediately issued a statement denouncing the murder of George Floyd. He spoke out himself as a commissioner of a major city in the United States of America. And as a Black man and a member of law enforcement, has been really honest and I think a leader in the nation regarding this moment we find ourselves in when we look at race and law enforcement and policing. So that's number one. He is not the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, which are the rank and file members of police that we overwhelmingly, I live in Roxbury, Chris. When I drive down to B2 or past B2, it is the rank and file police officers that we see every day in our communities, those hardworking men and women, those honorable men and women, those individuals, that union did not issue a public statement and still has not issued a public statement, to my knowledge, denouncing the murder of George Floyd by police. nor has, my understanding, the Boston Police Detectives Union issued a public-facing statement, or certainly not one that I've seen. I have spoken to the president of the Boston Police Detectives Union, who is a Black man. We have been on calls together, and we are going to work together with respect to the reforms and the changes that are coming down the pipe. But I think people need to recognize, just because the commissioner says something, he's representing management. What is the union saying? What are the unions? There are three that represent Boston police officers, detectives, and others. So their silence is deafening. And what I will say to you, Chris,
but they're not entirely silent. I want to know how it feels when the union says that your words, in their words, undoubtedly incited violence against the proud men and women of the Boston Police Department.
Yeah. What I will say before I answer that is Zappos, the shoe company, issued a statement about George Floyd. Ben and Jerry's has issued a statement about the George Floyd murder. McDonald's has issued the statement about the George Floyd murder. My fitness company has issued a statement about the George Floyd murder and also told me I need to start going to the gym and haven't been there in months, but that's irrelevant. But you get it, Chris, right? These entities that are not police recognize the moment we're in. And this is the problem that I see with law enforcement, including DAs, is we dig our heels in and are fearful that any move showing what they believe is weakness is somehow going to open the floodgates. I think acknowledging wrongdoing anywhere is strength. And so for me, I honestly am unmoved by the statements of the BPPA because they could muster up enough energy to draft a letter against me, but haven't thought it necessary enough to publicly denounce the murder by police of George Floyd, the murder by police of Breonna Taylor, and all of these other things that we're seeing right now. We are in a moment, and I believe that they are on the wrong side of history by being silent. And what I am proud to say is that, you know, I have a letter from the NAACP in Boston, the Mass Black Lawyers Association, the Mass Association of Hispanic Attorneys, Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, which is hundreds and hundreds of faith leaders in the Greater Boston area, the ACLU, the Lawyers for Civil Rights, members of the Black Ministerial Alliance, and clergy, as well as legislators that have all signed a letter denouncing what the BPPA did to me. I would put my squad up against them any day with respect to where we stand regarding Black individuals' encounters with law enforcement and the need for change.
Come back to the big project of anti-racist law enforcement. What was the racial disproportion in the old order of prosecutions and sentencing in the mass incarceration heyday? How did it happen? And what is coming to be the difference today?
So let me just clarify. I mean, I think when people say I am anti-police, I need you to hear me say, like I said,
I didn't hear you say that.
No. But they are claiming I'm anti-police. And I said, no, I'm anti-police brutality. I have members of my family that are law enforcement. I have a deep respect for the work that they do and the majority of the honorable men and women that do this incredibly hard job. What I will no longer tolerate, and the world and the nation is screaming this and burning our nation in rage because of it, is silence by good members of law enforcement as they sit and watch these known outliers and predators and violent and vile individuals engage in behavior that harms. And so remember, Chris, and I will promise I'll answer your question. The police are the only branch of our government that can kill you without any oversight, right? People are have no problem screaming out about the RMV. And if they came back and said, the Registry of Motor Vehicles, and they said, you know, shut up, 4 hours is a perfect amount of time to wait for your license, we would say, are you crazy? Our tax dollars pay for you to do this. What are you talking about? Be better. But for whatever reason, whenever people ask for reforms or changes with the police, these unions who are powerful, and I am a proponent of unions, not an opponent, a proponent of unions, somehow bang the drum of your anti-police if you ever talk to them about changes and reforms. So what I did, Chris, when I came into office was you know, and I was elected, I'm proud to say, with over 40% of the vote in a Democratic primary of five total people, one of whom all of the police and the mayor and others endorsed, right. Is we are going to have some space between my office and the police when there's an officer-involved shooting or excessive force or harm by an officer. And that's why I created the first in the nation discharge integrity team.
Discharge meaning discharge of a weapon.
Or discharge of your duty. So for example, we hope this never happens, but every city is one incident away from being Ferguson or being Minneapolis. So for me, I created a four-person team. It has a community member that leads the health center and is a survivor of homicide, a criminal defense lawyer, a retired member of the judiciary, and a member of law enforcement. And we do not even meet in my office. It is so removed that the meetings and the presentations to my discharge integrity team happen at a separate and outside location. We meet once a month and they help me direct and control the investigations into all officer-involved shootings and discharges of course, weapons, and then I would argue discharge of duty. So if George Floyd happened here, it would be in front of my discharge integrity team. And I can also say there's a woman on that panel, and half of the panel is diverse and African-American. So we have been deliberate about involving community. We have been deliberate about involving communities that overwhelmingly are coming into contact with law enforcement. And we are deliberate about including communities that overwhelmingly are the ones that are harmed when, and sometimes justifiably, I need to be very clear about that, there are justifiable and reasonable discharges of officers' weapon to protecting our community and protecting themselves. But that is what I've done to try to give the community some hope that there is not a bias in my office toward always finding that everything the police do is reasonable and justified.
The question to political candidates this spring, Rachel Rollins, is whether they support defunding or in the extreme abolishing the police. How about dismantling, the word that came out of the Minneapolis City Council after the George Floyd murder? What is to be done with those budgets, those assignments? What's the connection between over-prosecution, which you felt you inherited, and over-policing?
Let's start with the nation, Chris. The outrage for Ahmaud Arbery was, of course, not just a lynching that we witnessed, where a group of individuals, vigilantes essentially, followed this man, stalked him, boxed him in, and then executed him all under the guise of a citizen's arrest. Mm. And, you know, we've all seen the videos of white couples walking into that abandoned property and white children walking in, and nobody stalked and murdered them, right? But nonetheless, what we saw was the abject failure of law enforcement. So he was murdered February 23rd of this year. The world didn't know about Ahmaud Arbery until May, when a video leaked of that execution, of that stalking and execution, the felony murder that we witnessed. The Glenn County Police Department asked the Georgia Bureau of Investigations to get involved, not because they wanted help with the murder investigation. They wanted to find out who leaked the video. Yeah. There were three DAs that looked at that video and said, nope, looks fine to me. No charges. And then the Georgia Bureau of Investigations came in and within 24 hours had charged the McMichaels family and then later charged the individual that videoed the execution and boxed Ahmaud Arbery in. That is an abject failure of DAs. And, you know, I get it. We look down in Georgia and this looks like the cast of Deliverance to us up in the north, right? So what we are dealing with is this incestuous behavior. And remember, Travis McMichael was, we now know, uttered a racial slur as Ahmaud Arbery was gasping his last breaths after he murdered him. And we also know that Travis's father had worked for decades in the DA's office that had jurisdiction and had formerly been a Glynn County police officer. So that's setting the table about it is not just police who kill, rogue police officers who engage in violent, criminal, and racist behavior. It is the willful ignorance of the district attorneys who then essentially allow this vigilante behavior and criminality to fester and grow in law enforcement, because that bad behavior is reinforced when you aren't reprimanded or disciplined, certainly for a homicide. So, and the last thing I will say is, even with George Floyd, Chris, we saw only Derek Chauvin was charged by the DA. The DA, instead of having a spine, rather tried to throw a Black woman, a state's attorney in Baltimore, under the bus to say, I didn't want what happened in Freddie Gray to happen here, when he, instead of just saying, I'm scared, I want to make sure we get this right. And remember, he said to everyone in the African community, please know I'll do my very level best. This moron doesn't even know the difference between Africans and African Americans. So our community has just been so disrespected and dishonored by elected officials, overwhelmingly white men, who have done nothing and thought they don't need to cater to us, even though we are unfortunately the largest user of the criminal legal system. So he failed. And then unfortunately, the AG had to come in. And when the attorney general came in, he immediately charged Chauvin with second degree murder and charged the three other officers that were bystanders. So people have lost faith in the local DAs. And I think justifiably so. It's why I ran for office.
And the city council, to me, that was a real stroke, said, this is not public safety. We got to change it, dismantle it. What's your word for what's got to be done with the police budgets?
Right. And so I will also say I'm proud that the overwhelming majority of minority city councilors in Boston all signed that letter supporting me and demanding an apology from the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association as well. So what I will say is, no, we absolutely need to look at the budget of the Boston Police Department for sure. But I would never advocate for a world in Boston where there were no police. That, as a newly elected DA, 17 months in this office, Chris, I have seen horrific crimes committed by individuals that the media would like you to believe are the most violent and awful and horrific people in the world. We are pumped with images overwhelmingly of white police officers killing unarmed Black men. And we are pumped with images by the media of Black men being criminals. None of those things are always true. And in fact, the majority of times they aren't. But that is what we are consciously and subconsciously pumped with by our media.
But come back to the crimes that you call horrific.
The crimes that I called horrific, if you asked me, there are people that need to be removed from our community. And I will be very candid, a restorative justice circle is not going to fix the problem. They need to be removed because they are committing harm. And so there has to be a place, and currently we have jails and prisons where we are placing individuals when they are violent and harming and incapable of comporting with decency and honor in our communities. But I will tell you, Chris, the most horrific crime I have witnessed in my life was committed by a middle to upper class white woman from West Roxbury on Christmas Day when she threw her two children off of a garage.
Oh,
and that is not the face of who we think of as violent harmers or individuals that commit heinous acts. So mental illness is real. You know, we have trauma and harm that we have experienced, but I think we need to start talking about the types of harms to our community and where we are going to ask for assistance in that circumstance.
Where are you going to look?
I support, Chris, a look at, you know, all of the money that we are giving to the Boston Police Department. I think, you know, the fact that they receive four times the funding of the Boston Public Health Commission is troubling. I think that when we look at the budget of the Boston Police, the fact that they've significantly reduced the budget for the Bureau of Professional Standards and the Bureau of Professional Development, which are essentially the, you know, they include the anti-corruption division and internal affairs division and the police academy and firearms training program. Essentially, the things that are ensuring professionalism and accountability, those things are being slashed in the police budget. I think that, you know, we have to have a real conversation about the fact that, you know, there are police officers making $355,000 a year due to overtime. You know,
you mean the top brass or patrolmen working round the clock or on private details?
Yeah, I'm talking about many of this, you know, only 60% of that $355,000 a year that the highest paying employees in 2019, the majority of that is overtime and other. And of course, what is other? But again,
what is other?
I think that's a great question for you to ask the police or the mayor. But I think when you look at this, why these numbers are so exorbitant is because there is basically a monopoly on police operating details at construction sites and a required four-hour minimum for pay for any court appearance. These are areas where I think we can start discussing possibly trimming some of the fat. But I would never support a situation where there were no police officers at all. I think there needs to be significant reform, but I think the police need to be at the table. And I also think the community needs to be at the table.
Coming up, where she got that battle-tested taste for hard conversations. This is Open Source. It can be an awkward question these days. Just who is willing to be held accountable for police performance in cities all over the country? I'm engaging the elected chief prosecutor in Boston, Rachel Rollins. I don't know how to describe the situation in Boston. Our mayor speaks of the police as a peace force. First order of business is to de-escalate every kind of confrontation, much less violence. And yet the Boston police cars have run into crowds. There have been a lot of pepper spray, mace, whatever. And it can be rough at the street level. Sometimes it looks unnecessarily so. Is the police system accountable to our mayor? In New York, Mayor de Blasio ran on a police reform platform, but has seemed to have been co-opted entirely by their union power. What is the situation in Boston as you read it?
I mean, I think what was so troubling as well about George Floyd is it was just an almost recreation of Eric Garner in New York,
yes.
Right? The black man who was selling loose cigarettes, which is a civil infraction. It's not even a crime. He should have been written a ticket and fined, if even. And as he screamed, "I can't breathe," the life was sucked out of him. But that officer, it took 5 years for that officer to be fired. So where I see a glimmer of hope is Mayor Fry, within 24 hours, terminated the four police officers that were involved in George Floyd's murder. So that's number one. Number two, yes, the mayor, you know, might call this a peace force instead of a police force, but the mayor is also not in the demographic that is being, you know, when I worked as the president of the Mass Black Lawyers Association or the chair of legal redress for the Boston branch of the NAACP, and as the sibling of individuals that have cycled, unfortunately, in and out of our county, state, and federal prison system, it's very easy as a white man to say, this system works great because you aren't the one that's experiencing it like others are. So I will leave it at that with respect to a peace force. Yes, certainly are there members of the police department that are peaceful? Of course there are.
Is the police force answerable to the mayor, in fact?
Allegedly they are. I mean, I guess what's great about our Boston City Council now is we're going to see if in fact they are. The Boston City Council has the ability to vote up or down the budget. And that is coming up in the very near future. I think when we see the changes, Chris, in New York, you saw that last night or the day before, they no longer allow to be confidential incidents of, you know, infractions against police officers or disciplines against police officers, excessive force charges, all of those used to be confidential. When we look at a Derek Chauvin, and I will not refer to him as an officer because it disgraces the word officer, for the good men and women that do that job. Derek Chauvin had something like 17 infractions on his record. He had been involved in multiple other officer-involved shootings. If you had 17 infractions, Chris, at Market Basket or Sephora, you would be fired. If you showed up late to work at McDonald's three times, you would be fired. Why is it that the police, with the power to kill, allow people that are disgraced, dishonored, and the community is made clear are engaging in excessive force or violence to them to continue to engage in policing where they are given a weapon and essentially have the legal and lethal authority to kill at will with oversight after the fact? So I think we have to think about some significant reforms. That's what we're seeing with federal legislation about removing qualified immunity with respect to police officers. We're looking at federal oversight, Chris, regarding any officer-involved shootings or officer discipline that has to go up, be reported to a federal organization. So I have proposed this well before George Floyd. And, you know, we haven't even talked yet, Chris, about COVID-19, which is, of course, obviously the global pandemic that has been in the background of all of this unrest that is deeply impacting certain communities more than others.
Yeah, a hugely related story, certainly in the consciousness raising about the meaning of being Black in this culture, in this country. But it may be another story. Let me ask, whatever happened to community policing? Is that one of the possibilities going forward, a revival of that notion? It caught on in Boston for a while.
Yes. And so let me just push back a little bit about COVID-19 being a different issue. When we look at the photos from maybe a couple weeks ago in New York, when we see police officers, you know, in Brooklyn or the Bronx beating an 18-year-old for not appropriately socially distancing, and on that same day elsewhere, handing out masks to well-meaning white individuals that are sunbathing in a park, that juxtaposition in the same state at the same moment, at the same time, by the same police force, I think very crisply details what Black and brown and poor people of all races and backgrounds experience with law enforcement. So that's number one. Number two, community policing is incredibly important. But when we see that contrasting with, you know, for example, Boston police have a wonderful community engagement branch where an exceptional officer, Nora Bastin, is leading that unit. But Chris, I'm a lawyer and I worked at a big law firm prior to becoming the DA of Suffolk County. And to me, this is no different than having a diversity committee that looks great when you say we have a diversity committee, but the diversity committee isn't on the executive committee. The diversity committee isn't invited to any of the meetings when the finances of the firm are discussed. Diversity is not one of the critical factors that determine individuals' compensation. So, you know, it's one thing to have a community engagement or community policing unit. If they are not intricately involved in the executive meetings and don't have a loud and equally weighted voice with respect to the decisions and policies that are made by, you know, for example, the Youth Violence Task Force or other units that come in contact frequently with communities of color, overwhelmingly Black and brown, then to me, it's no different than having some isolated unit that comes out in the day and hands out ice cream and plays basketball, all of things that are very important and that I personally am deeply involved with. But if they don't have a say in some of the excessive force allegations or some of the internal affairs or anti-corruption investigations, this rings hollow to some in certain communities.
Rachel Rollins, where do we go from here? Where do you go from here? But start with defining this incredible moment we're in. Confused can be terribly depressing. Something's dying, but maybe something's being born. How do you describe it?
I started this session by telling you the letter that I wrote to my staff and read to my staff. There's a line that says, even after a week, I am all at once heartbroken, furious, and completely exhausted. Mm. But I will tell you, there's also a section in here where I say that I'm hopeful. I think we are in a moment where we are going to start having the conversations we've needed to have with people at the table that have never been invited before. They have been spoken about and spoken to. They have been spoken for, but never had a voice themselves at the table to say what it is they need and what their experience is with this system, with this government. I'm proud, Chris, of the fact that, you know, I have never backed down from a challenge or a hard conversation in my life, and certainly not as the district attorney of Suffolk County. I stood in front of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association for close to an hour and a half and fielded every one of their questions. I want to tell you, I am ever optimistic and hopeful because even though there have been moments that seem tense between me and some of the leaders in Massachusetts, we respect each other. I want you to hear me say that the head of ICE in Boston, Chief Lyons, sent me a beautiful text. And I sued ICE, right? But Chief Lyons sent a text in all of this turmoil to say, I hope you and your family are safe and well. And that is what I see as the hope of Boston, right? We can continue to not agree potentially with where we stand or the positions that our respective organizations are taking, but we still see the humanity in each other. So I have a coffee that is coming up this Friday with the president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, the new president. I have had a very strong, open and honest relationship with the former president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, still speak to him frequently as well. And this new president, I intend to sit down and listen to what it is he'd like to say on Friday. I have also said to all of the chiefs and commissioners in Suffolk County, we are going to have a private meeting where I sit and listen actively to what it is they have to say to me about statements I've made and my, you know, positions regarding law enforcement. And then they are going to sit and actively listen to me, not only as the chief law enforcement officer in Suffolk County, but as a Black woman and person who has had exceptional experiences with law enforcement and others that are not exceptional. So this is the beginning of a very much needed and crucial conversation. And we have agreed that we will meet and we will allow other people in the future to come and speak to us. And I think we are going to be leading the nation and how this reform moves forward with all of these different voices at the table when we move toward change.
Where did that part of your temperament, character come from that you don't avoid the tough questions? You don't stand down.
You know, I grew up as a biracial child in 1971 in the Boston area. My dad is an incredibly pale but handsome white Irish male, and my mother at the time had an Angela Davis afro and is beautiful and brown, and you know, they were a striking couple that you could not ignore as they walked around with their United Colors of Benetton child factory, right? Like there were five of us that ranged in all colors, shapes, hues, blue eyes, green eyes, curly hair, straight hair. We were a sight to behold. Race has always been something we've talked about in our family from childhood. I also had the privilege of going to Buckingham Brown and Nichols, where I was one of a very small handful of diverse students at the time. I'm class of 1989. Where I believe I got the tools that I need to master the world, right? And a world that I am often the first or the only in every room that I stand in every position that I've ever held. Chris, I'm the first woman in the history of Suffolk County to ever be DA, woman of any kind ever in the history of Suffolk County, which dates back to 1806 is when Suffolk County started and the first DA was appointed then. Or elected. And I am the first woman of color in the history of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, of all 11 DAs. So this is not new to me, this uncomfortable space where I have to assimilate and code shift and be fluent in multiple different worlds all at the same time while staying true to myself, which is something I will say, Chris, as a breast cancer survivor and the mother of a 16-year-old teenager who is grouchy more often than she is kind, I feel like I've been battle-tested and proven in my life that this part is easy. getting through the tough conversations. And, you know, my background, honestly, I have a background in labor and employment. I've negotiated collective bargaining agreements. I think all of the skills that I have in my life have led me to this moment where we are going to continue to sit down and talk. I am willing to facilitate that. I have been the architect of calling all of these individuals together. I think we are the first in the nation to have done so. And many other DAs across the country that are progressive have very strained relationships with their law enforcement partners. We don't have that in Suffolk County. And if we do, we're going to talk about it. And we're going to get to a point where we can either agree to disagree, but respect each other's position and move forward.
There's the first you didn't mention. You're the first DA I've ever met who says that when the going gets tough, you fall back on the words of James Baldwin. Talk about that.
James Baldwin said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. You know, we keep starting to have this conversation in the middle regarding the Black community and the police. Mm-hmm. And we have to atone. We have to reckon with the history that this country has had, not only with Native Americans, obviously, first and foremost, but for me also, with, you know, the enslavement of 20 people brought to Virginia back in 1619. It is all a bloody thread that is woven through the fabric of this country. Our blood as Black people is in the soil of this country that we helped to build. And unfortunately, we have a government that we pay into. We have a country that we built with our hands. And as I said, our blood is in its soil. And we aren't getting the same benefits as our brothers and sisters here. So, you know, it's funny. There's a beautiful phrase that said, the burden of the brutalized is not to comfort the bystander. There was a young man who said this at the Black Entertainment Awards a few years back. And it was actually on the birthday of, I think, Tamir Rice. But essentially, and that if you have a critique for the resistance and for our resistance as Black people, then you better have an established record of critique for our oppression. And we see a lot of people speaking now because they're uncomfortable and they want to say, you know, all lives matter or I don't see color. And that's sort of what I said in my letter, is that this is a time for privileged people, of which there are many, to be quiet and to learn, right? And to be an ally rather than pushing harmed people with lived experiences in this moment out of the way so that you can feel more comfortable and say something to, you know, fill the uncomfortable silence. We need to sit here as a nation in this moment, and we need to feel what an overwhelming majority of certain communities are feeling right now. But I will tell you, Chris, I am in all of that optimistic and hopeful. And the person who said those quotes that I just gave, his name is Jesse Williams, who gave just a riveting and amazing speech a few years back. And this was before George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and Tony McDade and David McAtee, as well as, you know, Omar Jimenez and Christian Cooper. We've just had a hell of a few weeks where people are, you know, experiencing vicarious trauma of all races and backgrounds because we have witnessed lynchings and murders and hate and rage, and we are better than this, but we need to do the hard work of healing.
Rachel Rollins, I love your man, James Baldwin, but I turn maybe more often to the great Ralph Waldo Emerson. He closed his first book of essays in an essay on nature, 1841, on the note that the world is ever being remade. He said, spirit alters, molds, makes it. Build, therefore, your own world. As fast as you conform your life to the pure idea in your mind, that will unfold its great proportions. He was an optimist, too, in terrible times. Thank you so much, Rachel Rollins, for your work and for sharing so much with us.
I am honored to speak to you, Chris. I hope this is not the last time we do.
Visit our website for lots more conversations at radioopensource.org. And while you're there, think of supporting our team. The best way is on Patreon. Subscribers get to hear producer Adam Coleman in his ongoing series about reading in a time of social distance. This week, Amy Brady on pandemic fiction and climate change. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our district attorney. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.